Chapter 27, Friedman's Restatement of the Quantity Theory of Money. Page 202. Introduction. Following the publication of Keynes' general theory in 1936, economists discarded the traditional quantity theory of money. But at the University of Chicago, the quantity theory continued to be central and vigorous part of the oral tradition throughout the 1930s and 1940s. At Chicago, Milton Friedman, Henry Simmons, Lloyd Meigs, Frank Knight, and Jacob Wiener taught and developed a more suitable and relevant version of the quantity theory of money in its theoretical form, in which the quantity theory was connected and integrated with general price theory. The foremost exponent of the Chicago version of the quantity theory of money, who led the so-called monetarist revolution, is Professor Friedman. He, in his essay, The Quantity Theory of Money, a restatement published in 1956, set down a particular model of quantity theory of money. Note 1. Milton Friedman edited Studies in the Quantity Theory of Money, 1956, pages 3 to 21. This is discussed below. Friedman's theory. In his reformulation of the quantity theory, Friedman asserts that the quantity theory is in the first instance a theory of the demand for money. It is not a theory of output or of money income or of the price level. The demand for money on the part of ultimate wealth holders is formally identical with that of the demand for a consumption service. He regards the amount of real cash balances, M by P, as a commodity which is demanded because it yields services to the person who holds it. Thus, money is an asset or capital good. Hence, the demand for money forms part of capital or wealth theory. For ultimate wealth holders, the demand for money in real terms may be expected to be a function primarily of the following variables. 1. Total wealth. The total wealth is the analog of the budget constraint. It is a total that must be divided among various forms of assets. In practice, estimates of total wealth are seldom available. Instead, income may serve as an index of wealth. Thus, according to Friedman, income is a surrogate of wealth. 2. The division of wealth between human and non-human forms. The major source of wealth is the productive capacity of human beings, which is human wealth. But the conversion of human wealth into non-human wealth or the reverse is subject to institutional constraints. This can be done by using current earnings to purchase non-human wealth or by using non-human wealth to finance the acquisition of skills. Thus, the fraction of total wealth in the form of non-human wealth is an additional important variable. Friedman calls the ratio of non-human to human wealth or the ratio of wealth to income as small w. 3. The expected rates of return on money and other assets. These rates of return are counterparts of the prices of a commodity and its substitutes and complements in the theory of consumer demand. The nominal rate of return may be zero, as it generally is on currency, or negative, as it sometimes is on demand deposits subject to net service charges, or positive, as it is on demand deposits on which interest is paid, and generally on time deposits. The nominal rate of return on other assets consists of two parts. First, any currently paid yield or cost, such as interest on bonds, dividends on equities, and cost of storage on physical assets. And second, changes in the prices of these assets, which become specially important under conditions of inflation or deflation. Page 203. 4. Other variables. Variables other than income may affect the utility attached to the services of money, which determine liquidity proper. Besides liquidity, variables are the tastes and preferences of wealth holders. Another variable is trading in existing capital goods by ultimate wealth holders. These variables also determine the demand function for money along with other forms of wealth. Such variables are noted as small u by Friedman. Broadly, total wealth includes all sources of income or consumable services. It is capitalized income. By income, Friedman means permanent income, which is the average expected yield on wealth during its lifetime. Forms of wealth. Wealth can be held in five different forms: money, bonds, equities, physical goods, and human capital. Each form of wealth has a unique characteristic of its own and a different yield. 1. Money is taken in the broadest sense to include currency, demand deposits, and time deposits, which yield interest on deposits. Thus, money is luxury good. It also yields real return in the form of convenience, security, etc. to the holder, which is measured in the terms of general price level, capital P. 2. Bonds are defined as claim to a time stream of payments that are fixed in nominal units. 3. Equities are defined as a claim to a time stream of payments that are fixed in real units. 4. Physical goods or non-human goods are inventories of producer and consumer durables. And 5. Human capital is the productive capacity of human beings. Thus, each form of wealth has a unique characteristic of its own and a different yield, either explicitly in the form of interest, dividends, labor income, etc., or implicitly in the form of services of money measured in the terms of P and inventories. The present discounted value of these expected income flows from these five forms of wealth constitutes the current value of wealth, which can be expressed as capital W is equal to small y upon small r, where capital W is the current value of total wealth, small y is the total flow of expected income from the five forms of wealth, and small r is the interest rate. This equation shows that wealth is capitalized income. Friedman, in his latest empirical study, Monetary Trends in the United States and the United Kingdom, 1982, gives the following demand function for money for an individual wealth holder with slightly different notations from his original study of 1956 as M upon P is equal to function of, within bracket we have, small y, small w, R M, R subscript B, R E, small g subscript P, and small u, end of bracket, where capital M is the total stock of money demanded, P is the price level, small y is the real income, small w is the fraction of wealth in non-human form, R M is the expected nominal rate of return on money, R B is the expected rate of return on bonds, including expected changes in their prices, RE is the expected nominal rate of return on equities, including expected changes in their prices, small g subscript P is equal to 1 upon P dP by dt is the expected rate of change of prices of goods and hence the expected nominal rate of return on physical assets, and small u stands for variables other than income that may affect the utility attached to the services of money. The demand function for business is roughly similar, although the division of total wealth and human wealth is not very useful, since a firm can buy and sell in the marketplace and hire its human wealth at will, but the other factors are important. The aggregate demand function for money is the summation of individual demand functions, with M and small y referring to per capita money holdings and per capita real income respectively, and small w is the function of aggregate wealth in non-human form. The demand function for money leads to the conclusion that a rise in expected yields on different assets, that is RB, RE and GP, reduces the amount of money demanded by a wealth holder, and that an increase in wealth raises the demand for money. The income to which cash balances, M upon P, are adjusted is the expected long-term level of income rather than current income being received. Empirical evidence suggests that the income elasticity of demand for money is greater than unity, which means that income velocity is falling over the long run. This means that the long-run demand for money function is stable and is relatively interest inelastic as shown in figure 1, where MD is the demand for money curve. If there is a change in the interest rate, the long run demand for money is negligible. So in figure 1, we have money balances on the x-axis and interest rate on the y-axis. So MD curve is a straight line curve dropping very fast, which is very, very nearly parallel to the y-axis. Page 204. In Friedman's restatement of the quantity theory of money, the supply of money is independent of the demand for money. The supply of money is unstable due to the actions of monetary authorities. On the other hand, the demand for money is stable. It means that money which people want to hold in cash or bank deposits is related in a fixed way to their permanent income. If the central bank increases the supply of money by purchasing securities, people who sell securities will find their holdings of money have increased in relation to their permanent income. They will therefore spend their excess holdings of money partly on assets and partly on consumer goods and services. This spending will reduce their money balances and at the same time raise the nominal income. On the contrary, a reduction in the money supply by selling securities on the part of the central bank will reduce the holdings of money of the buyers of securities in relation to their permanent income. They will therefore raise their money holdings partly by selling their assets and partly by reducing their consumption expenditure on goods and services. This will tend to reduce nominal income. Thus, on both counts, the demand for money remains stable. According to Friedman, a change in the supply of money causes a proportionate change in the price level or income or in both. Given the demand for money, it is possible to predict the effects of changes in the supply of money on total expenditure and income. If the company is operating at less than full employment level, an increase in the supply of money will raise output and employment with a rise in total expenditure. But this is only possible in the short run. Friedman's quantity theory of money is explained in figure 2, where output Y is measured on the vertical axis and the demand for and supply of money are measured on the horizontal axis. So trying to explain figure 2, demand and supply of money is on the x-axis and income on the y-axis. We have the demand curve MD, which is a straight line passing through the origin. There are two supply curves S and S1, such that S1 is to the right of S. The S curve intersects MD curve at point E. Corresponding to that point, money is M and income is Y. The supply curve S1 intersects the demand curve at E1. Corresponding to that, money is M1 and income is Y1. Returning to the text. So MD is the demand for money curve, which varies with income. MS is the money supply curve, which is perfectly inelastic to changes in income. I forgot to mention that S and S1 are straight lines which are parallel to the income axis. The two curves intersect at E and determine the equilibrium income OY. If the money supply rises, the MS curve shifts to the right to M1 S1. As a result, the money supply is greater than the demand for money, which raises total expenditure until new equilibrium is established at E1 between MD and M1 S1 curves and income rises to OY1. Thus, Friedman represents the quantity theory as the theory of demand for money, and the demand for money is assumed to depend on asset prices or relative returns and wealth or income. He shows how a theory of the stable demand for money becomes a theory of prices and output. A discrepancy between the nominal quantity of money demanded and the nominal quantity of money supplied will be evident primarily in attempted spending. As the demand for money changes in response to changes in its determinants, it follows that substantial changes in prices or nominal income are almost invariably the result of changes in the nominal supply of money. Its criticisms. Friedman's reformulation of the quantity theory of money has evoked much controversy and has led to empirical verification on part of Keynesians and the monetarists. Some of the criticisms leveled against the theory are discussed as under. 1. Very broad definition of money. Friedman has been criticized for using the broad definition of money, which not only includes currency and demand deposits M1, but also time deposits with commercial banks M2. This broad definition leads to the obvious conclusion that the interest elasticity of the demand for money is negligible. If the rate of interest increases on time deposits, the demand for them, M2, rises. But the demand for currency and demand deposits, M1, falls. So the overall effect of the rate of interest will be negligible on the demand for money. But Friedman's analysis is weak in that he does not make a choice between long-term and short-term interest rates. In fact, if demand deposits, M1, are used, a short-term rate is preferable, while a long-term rate is better with time deposits M2. Such an interest rate structure is bound to influence the demand for money. Page 205. 2. Money not a luxury good. Friedman regards money as a luxury good because of the inclusion of time deposits in money. This is based on his finding that there is higher trend rate of the money supply than income in the United States. But no such luxury effect has been found in the case of England. 3. More importance to wealth variables. In Friedman's demand for money function, wealth variables are preferable to income, and the operation of wealth and income variables simultaneously does not seem to be justified. As pointed out by Johnson, income is the return on wealth and wealth is the present value of income. The presence of the rate of interest and one of these variables in the demand for money function would appear to make the other superfluous. 4. Money supply not exogenous. Friedman takes the supply of money to be unstable. The supply of money is varied by the monetary authorities in an exogenous manner in Friedman's system. But the fact is that in the United States, the money supply consists of bank deposits created by changes in bank lending. Bank lending in turn is based upon bank reserves, which expand and contract with A. deposits and withdrawals of currency by non-bank financial intermediaries, B. borrowings by commercial banks from the Federal Reserve System, C. inflows and outflows of money from and to abroad, and D. purchase and sale of securities by the Federal Reserve System. The first three items definitely impart an endogenous element to the money supply. Thus, the money supply is not exclusively exogenous as assumed by Friedman. It is mostly endogenous. 5. Ignores the effect of other variables on money supply. Friedman also ignores the effect of prices, output, or interest rates on the money supply. But there is considerable empirical evidence that the money supply can be expressed as a function of the above variables. 6. Does not consider time factor. Friedman does not tell about the timing and the speed of adjustment or the length of time to which his theory applies. 7. No positive correlation between money supply and money GNP. Money supply and money GNP have been found to be positively correlated in Friedman's findings. But according to Calder, note 2, N. Calder, The New Monetarism, LBR, July 1970. So, according to Calder, in Britain, the best correlation is to be found between the quarterly variations in the amount of cash held in the form of notes and coins by the public and corresponding variations in personal consumption at market prices, and not between money supply and GNP. Conclusion. Despite these criticisms, Johnson writes, Friedman's application to monetary theory of the basic principle of capital theory, that is, the yield on capital and capital and the present value of income, is probably the most important development in monetary theory since Keynes's general theory. Its theoretical significance lies in the conceptual integration of wealth and income as influences on behavior. Friedman versus Keynes. Friedman's demand for money function differs from that of Keynes in many ways, which are discussed as under. First, Friedman uses a broader definition of money than that of Keynes in order to explain his demand for money function. He treats money as an asset or capital good capable of serving as a temporary abode of purchasing power. It is held for the stream of income or consumable services which it renders. On the other hand, the Keynesian definition of money consists of demand deposits and non-interest-bearing debt of government. Second, Friedman postulates a demand for money function quite different from that of Keynes. The demand for money on the part of wealth holders is a function of many variables. These are RM, the yield on money, RB, the yield on bonds, RE, the yield on securities, GP, the yield on physical assets, and small u, referring to other variables. In the Keynesian theory, the demand for money as an asset is confined to just bonds, where interest rates are the relevant cost of holding money. Third, there is also the difference between the monetary mechanisms of Keynes and Friedman as to how changes in the quantity of money affect economic activity. According to Keynes, monetary changes affect economic activity indirectly through bond prices and interest rates. The monetary authorities increase the money supply by purchasing bond, which raises their prices and reduces the yield on them. Lower yield on bonds induces people to put their money elsewhere, such as investment in new productive capital that will increase output and income. On the other hand, in Friedman's theory, monetary disturbances will directly affect prices and production of all types of goods, since people will buy or sell any asset held by them. Friedman emphasizes that the market interest rates play only a small part of the total spectrum of rates that are relevant. Page 206. Fourth, there is a difference between the two approaches with regard to the motives for holding money balances. Keynes divides money balances into active and idle categories. The former consists of transactions and precautionary motives, and the latter consists of the speculative motive of holding money. On the other hand, Friedman makes no such division of money balances. According to him, money is held for assets, total wealth, human wealth, and general preferences, tastes, and anticipations. Fifth, in his analysis, Friedman introduces permanent income and nominal income to explain his theory. Permanent income is the amount a wealth holder can consume while maintaining his wealth intact. Nominal income is measured in the prevailing units of currency. It depends on both prices and quantities of goods traded. Keynes, on the other hand, does not make such a distinction. Exercises. Question 1. Explain the contribution of Milton Friedman to the quantity theory of money. 2. Critically examine the statement that the revised version of the quantity theory of money is that there exists a stable demand function for real money holdings. 3. Explain Friedman's reformulation of the quantity theory of money. How does it differ from that of Keynes? 4. Comment on the following statements. A. The quantity theory of money is a theory of demand for money. B. The quantity theory of money is a theory of money income determination. With this, we come to the end of chapter 27.